The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Stephen Rippon. I'm from Tall Oaks Classical School in Bear, Delaware. It's located in northern Delaware, very close to Maryland and Pennsylvania and New Jersey. We have students from all four of those states. And I'm happy to be here today to talk about the value of debate in the classical Christian school. So I tried to get these little slips of paper to each of you. If you didn't get one, there's still some on the chairs outside the door, and I still have a few. I also have outlines for my talk that are on the chairs outside the doors. Is there anyone who needs either of those? Because I can also bring them to you. Okay. And so I'm going to start by sharing my own experience and background in teaching argumentation and debate. And then I'll also explain what to do with these slips of paper. They're going to be part of a demonstration impromptu debate, just for the sake of demonstrating this and hopefully creating enough anxiety that keeps you awake during the sleepy hour. So I'm thankful. Usually my debate class is scheduled for the afternoon, and it helps because it keeps students awake at a time when they would otherwise be falling asleep. So I came to Tall Oaks Classical School in 2007, and my academic background had been in literature and theology. And at Tall Oaks, I was brought on to teach literature, rhetoric, and this ninth grade course called Argumentation and Debate. At Tall Oaks Classical School, our eighth graders take logic for a year, both formal logic and informal logic. And then in the ninth grade year, they studied argumentation and debate with me. Now, the debate course was the one that I was most worried about because I had no prior experience. I had never debated when I was a student, and I had never studied it. So I was grateful for the materials that I inherited from the previous teacher, Matthew Graydonis. And also what I had was a published activity guide from the National Association of Urban Debate Leagues. And I had a demonstration video of a debate from the Homeschool Legal Defense Association. And so those were what I had to work with, as well as a textbook called The Debater's Guide. And that has proven to be a great resource, The Debater's Guide. But what really encouraged me as a new debate teacher was the opportunity to debate against another classical Christian school, Rockbridge Academy, which is located near Annapolis, Maryland. It's about a 90-minute drive from where we live. Their debate teacher at the time, Bradley Finkbeiner, invited me to go down and observe his debate class, and then later invited us to participate in a tournament that they hosted as part of the Mid-Atlantic Christian Debate League. The topic that first spring that we debated with them was resolved. Intelligent design should be taught alongside Darwinian evolution in public schools as an alternative theory for the origin of life. Having a specific topic to prepare was a great motivation to my students to do research and to write cases. It helped focus my class toward a goal to have that competitive aspect. Since then, I've taught ninth grade argumentation and debate each year. One of the things that I enjoy most about teaching debate is that since we work on several different topics a year, I learn a lot along with the students about a variety of current topics, because my natural tendency would just to remain with the old books that I love. And I really appreciate it. Abraham's talk at the Chrysostom winner about the value of tradition. And I love that. I love the old books. I could spend all day with them. So debate really stretched me and stretches me still to probe into current events. And so I'm learning right along with the students as they're debating topics of current interest. Another thing that I have appreciated about teaching debate is that in debate class, or when using debates as part of an activity in another class, Once I establish a few ground rules, I don't have to say much. I can sit down and watch the students engage each other and probe each other and spur each other on to greater research and thought. And so I can just watch it happen. At our school, our principal has challenged us to find ways as teachers not just to be lecturing all the time. And even when we try to do great book style shared inquiry discussions or Socratic style discussions, the temptation is for me as the teacher to step in and try to steer things and correct things. This is always a challenge that the students end up just talking to me and looking for me to say, that's a great idea, and instead of feeding off of each other. But one great thing about debate is that the students feed off of each other. They learn how to listen to each other. They learn how to communicate clearly to each other. They take responsibility for their own learning. So in that spirit, I will be ultimately asking for two volunteers to do a demonstration impromptu mini debate. Now, this is where the slip of paper comes in that you should have. So on the slip of paper, I would like you to write a noun that completes the sentence. The sentence is, classical Christian education is like blank. So where that blank is, put a noun. It could be a person, a place, a thing. So classical Christian education is like, and so put a word there, a noun that completes that sentence. And so that's just write that one noun on the piece of paper. And then once you've thought of that, I will pass this around, fold up the piece of paper into as small a little thing as possible, concealing the word that you have written on there, and then put it in the jar. And so this will become what we call a random theme debate, because the topics will be chosen by the two demonstrators just out of whatever you get. So I'll start passing this around when you can just put your thing in there and just pass it back through the I'll go ahead and hand this off. So thank you. And so while that's going around, I'll explain a little bit more about our background. So we formed a debate team for 10th through 12th graders who wanted to compete with other schools. And this was in the Mid-Atlantic Christian Debate League, MACTL, and that's a nice-sounding debate title. It consists of three schools, Rockbridge and Summit Christian Academy in Yorktown, Virginia. But we're always open to have more members. So we're one reason why I wanted to come here was hoping to generate more interest in debate and to identify more people that we can compete with. Now, Summit in Yorktown, Virginia hosts a fall tournament every year, and we in Rockbridge take turns hosting a spring tournament. We're located about a five-hour drive from Yorktown, Virginia. And so it's always that's one of the highlights of the school year is to take that trip. We've had generous donors to fund hotel accommodations for us. Our debate team also participates in some events that include a broader selection of public and private schools. So one of these is called the Big Questions Debate, and another one is the Ronald Reagan Great Communicator Debate. These are good programs that while they include secular schools, private, public schools, they are consistent with what we're trying to do in classical education because they value rhetoric and they value worldview discussion, and they give us opportunities to engage with other schools. So I'll share more about these opportunities later. Now, within the classroom, I've also used debates, even in literature classes, as a way to draw out particular issues. So, for example, when I taught American literature, we had a debate on whether Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn should be revised to get rid of the offensive N-word. So one team of students had to argue the affirmative, that yes, Mark Twain's novel should be revised. The other team had to argue to keep the original text. So they argued the negative position. Now, debates like that could be part of the classroom experience in many other subjects like theology, history, science. So even if you don't compete with other schools, you may use debate fruitfully in your classrooms. And so one of the goals of my talk is to give you some structures where you can do that, and also to make a case for the value of doing this. So before I go on, it will help me to know your background as it relates to debate. So would you raise your hand if you have ever used debate in your classroom? Are there people who have done that? Okay. So that seems like more than half of you had. Would any of you like to share what sorts of topics you have had them debate in certain classes? Is there anyone who had ones that you thought worked well? Yes, ma'am.
We had one. I would teach sixth graders, and we were talking about, of all things, 1860s, the Civil War, right before the Civil War, slavery.
Yes.
And we were talking about immigration. So we incorporated in, should America still open its doors to immigration? And it caused my students to really realize that America was founded on immigration.
Yes.
What has become of us today?
Okay, so a sixth grade class debating, should America open its doors to immigrants? Okay. Are there other topics that you've used? Yes, ma'am.
In my speech debate elective class, one topic I found that the students really enjoyed was, is the world getting better or not?
Okay. Yes, that's excellent. So is the world getting better or not? Yes.
At our school, when they read The Hiding Place, the seventh graders debate the value of lying, whether it's right or wrong to lie.
Okay. So is it ever justified to tell a lie? So, yeah, those are excellent topics. That's really, so you already have lots of good ideas about the sorts of things that can be really fruitful in class discussion, not just in a debate tournament, but in advancing and connecting with whatever subject matter that you're dealing with. That's great. Now, another thing I'm interested in, did any of you have experience debating when you yourself were in middle school or high school? Does anyone have debate experience like that, like I didn't? Okay, there's a couple of hands that I see. Good. And so you mentioned that you have a debate elective. Are there other schools represented here that actually have a specific class or elective focused on debate? Okay, so there's a couple others already. Good. Well, one reason why I signed up for this workshop is because I knew that it would help me probe more deeply into this subject and would also bring me into contact with others who could help me grow in this area. And perhaps, if you're not too far away, to even debate with us. I hope that we can interact more after this session to share ideas, because like I said, I have no formal experience or training in debate. So I've been learning on the job these last 11 years. I learn new things each year. Now, if you haven't been doing anything with debate, another reason why I wanted to present this is to encourage you to start doing some debates in your classrooms, because I do believe that it has great value within classical Christian education. So one thing then, to sort of establish some basic things, so some of you already have experience with debate, but one thing I've learned in debate is that it's important to establish definitions up front. In debate, this is essential so that debaters don't just talk past each other. They need to agree about what the terms, the words that they're debating mean. And if they don't, then sometimes the debate has to settle that issue first before moving on to what the resolution actually means. So what is debate? Now, the Debater's Guide, the textbook that we use, defines it as formal oral controversy consisting of the systematic presentation of opposing arguments on a selected topic. I would expand that definition because debate does not have to be oral. There are forums for debating in writing. Some students enjoy debating online. There are some tournaments that involve submitting written cases. So while we practice debate with formal structures, another thing about that definition is that the skills learned in debating through these formal structures also do translate into more informal debates. So they apply to all kinds of conversation and decision-making processes. We might speak of somebody as having an internal debate. The authors of the Debater's Guide observe that every genuine choice involves a debate. So, for example, we had to debate as within ourselves, as a family, should we fly to the ACCS in Dallas or should we drive? And we chose to drive. So we're on in the middle of a big road trip all the way around the country, eventually out to Washington State and then back. One of the other great things about being a teacher and having some time in the summer. Now, how does debate fit within a classical Christian curriculum? In his Great Courses lecture on argumentation, and this is another resource that I got in my first year of teaching debate, David Zarefsky of Northwestern University offers a helpful discussion of argumentation as the place where rhetoric, logic, and dialectic overlap. Zarefsky explains, rhetoric is the art of persuasion, focused on influencing a particular audience. In the case of debate, that audience would be the judge. Debate is also applied logic. Not formal logic, but informal logic, which expresses reasoning patterns in ordinary language. And then dialectic refers to the deliberative process, discovering and testing knowledge through questions and answers. So an example of this is Plato's Socratic Dialogues. I have my ninth graders read Euthyphro and Apology in the debate class. Euthyphro is especially valuable because there Socrates is trying to find what is the definition of holiness and trying to probe a so-called expert on what holiness is. And so we see a great example of clarifying a definition and then also of a cross-examination process. Debate has its roots in the biblical and classical world. We see examples in Scripture and in the foundational works of Homer and Hesiod. Perhaps the debater's favorite Bible verse is Proverbs 18:17. The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him. The book of Job could be considered an informal debate among Job and his friends asked for the reason of Job's suffering. We also see informal debates in Homer among humans and among gods about which course of action to take. We see internal debates where Achilles struggles with when Agamemnon announces he's going to take Achilles' war prize, Briseis. Achilles struggles with whether to kill him on the spot or not. Hesiod in Works and Days mentions debate as an entertaining distraction from work. He admonishes his lazy brother not just to be a spectator at the debate. And later Greek philosophers also contributed to the development of the tradition. Protagoras has a fragment called the Two Logoi. He says, on every subject, there are two speeches which oppose each other. Now, Socrates was famously critical of Protagoras, Gorgias, and other sophists who, through the abuse of rhetoric, could make the weaker case seem to be the stronger without reference to what is actually true. This is an objection that we must deal with when we undertake debates in which teams are required or assigned to argue for a side that they disagree with. And I'll try to give some justification for that practice later. Now, one excellent resource for a historical perspective of debate is Isaac Watt's book on the improvement of the mind. George Grant gave an excellent overview of this yesterday. There are several chapters in this book where Isaac Watts advocates for the role of debate in developing one's mind. And he distinguishes three types: Socratic disputation, forensic disputation, and scholastic disputation. And he gives instructions on how to improve in each of these areas. Now, this is particularly valuable because he does it with reference to debating as a Christian. And so he does say, we don't just debate for the sake of winning, but for seeking the truth. The first type of debate that Isaac Watts mentions is Socratic debate. It took place among philosophers. We see this in Plato's dialogues. We use forms of debate that include this, something like the Socratic method, when we have cross-examinations. Watts also discusses forensic disputation. It took place in the ancient assemblies of Athens and Rome to deal with criminal cases, to discuss matters of policy. We see this still in modern political and ecclesiastical assemblies. One person makes a speech in favor of something, another makes a speech against it. It's all kept in order by a moderator. And with the great value of speeches in these assemblies, rhetoric became a highly valued skill. A third type of disputation, scholastic or syllogistic disputation, it flowed from a more rigorous application of formal logic, and it became a key part of scholarly engagement in the universities from the medieval world and through the early 19th century. A modern historian of debate, David Potter, focuses on the history of debate in the American colleges, and he talks about how in the early years of Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Brown, the type of debate that they did was this syllogistic disputation. They conducted them entirely in Latin. One student would be chosen to make an argument, and then another student would challenge that argument by attacking the major premises, the minor premises, or by questioning the usage of key words in the original argument. So some sample topics that they debated were from Harvard in 1653. They debated logic is the mercury of the arts. Or Yale in 1720. All simple ideas are clear. Or at Brown in 1811, this was a debate topic. To stand on one foot and then on the other is ridiculous in an orator. So, which makes me a little self-conscious up here. Many of the topics that we have records of were centered around logic and rhetoric itself. So it's has a very meta debate quality, debating about debate, debating about logic and rhetoric. So Potter, in his article, The Debate Tradition, talks about how syllogistic disputation gave way to forensic disputation because Latin and formal logic fell out of use, fell out of the curriculum. And so this forensic disputation was featured, especially at commencement exercises. They would debate topics that were of theological interest. Some examples were at Yale in 1747, whether any can be saved without divine revelation. Or at Yale, in another one from Yale in 1747, whether any good works can be meritorious. 1782 at Yale, they also, in the time of the American Revolution, were considering whether the British monarchical government would be preferable to the Republican government of the United States. They also debated whether the press ought to be free. Now, in the 19th century, though, as it went on, forensic disputation also fell away from the curriculum, but it became an extracurricular activity. And as intercollegiate athletics arose, debate also became a very competitive event between colleges. Have any of you seen the 2007 movie The Great Debaters with Denzel Washington? That's an excellent movie. I highly recommend that. I show that to my ninth grade debate class each year. It's set in Texas, in eastern Texas, at Wiley College in Marshall in the 1930s. And it talks about a historically black college that has a debate team, and they have to demonstrate the virtue of fortitude as they overcome a culture that's set against them. At first, they just debate other historically black colleges, but as they succeed and overcome lots of personal and institutional struggles, eventually are invited to debate at Harvard. It's based on a true story, although I think in the real event it wasn't Harvard where they ended up debating, but it's a very inspiring movie. But it shows that debate was something that would gather crowds to watch these debates take place. So it was a very competitive event. It was something that people would go and watch. Now, whether you're interested in doing more debates within your classroom or developing a competitive debate team at your school, there's some basic principles to understand. So one excellent resource for this is the Debater's Guide. It's now in its fourth edition. And so these are some basic principles. There's two basic rules of debate. First is to present one issue at a time. So you could think about how confusing it might be to play tennis with more than one ball in play. In the same way, you can only debate one resolution at a time. And then the second is to provide equal opportunity for presentation of each viewpoint. Now, this is another thing that's really great about debate because it challenges different types of students. You might have noticed in your classes that there's the students who would tend to dominate any kind of discussion when you try to have a Socratic discussion or shared inquiry, the ones who are always speaking up. Having a time limit, as we do in debate, challenges the student who would say too much to learn to be concise and to learn to curb that. But it also presents a challenge to the student who's very reticent and hesitant to speak up. You have to expand that natural terseness to fill the time, because otherwise you won't be as successful a debater. You just won't be able to get as much said. So it challenges both extremes of students. So they have equal opportunity. They have equal time where the floor is theirs, and they won't be interrupted except once the time expires. Some other terminology that's helpful to go over up front. So a proposition or resolution, that's a judgment expressed in a declarative statement. And so it's often stated in the affirmative. And so the affirmative side agrees with the resolution and tries to get the audience, the judge, to accept that, whereas the negative side, also called con, tries to prevent the affirmative side's effort. They can do this directly, or there's indirect methods of refutation. There's three main types of propositions. There's a proposition of policy, proposition of value, and a proposition of fact. So a policy, a key word there is should. There's an agent, the one who should act. There's the word should, and then there's a verb that has a specific action. So an example of a topic that we debated in our league recently is resolved. The United States should abolish birthright citizenship for children of illegal immigrants. Then there's the proposition of value. This does not call for a future action, but it makes an evaluation or a judgment. So you could do this historically, like resolved, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was morally justified. You can talk about a moral quandary. Like one we did in November 2016, it was the weekend before the presidential election, we went down to Summit Christian Academy and debated this. Resolved, it is morally right to vote for the lesser of two evils. So another topic we did last year was resolved. Christians are morally justified to use deadly force in self-defense. And then there's the proposition of fact, which usually isn't used in school debate, but it's asserting that a fact is true or that an event took place. Now this is a sort of debate that's more appropriate for the courtroom. Is there anybody who has a school or who does mock trial in here? Okay. Yeah, great. Yeah, and of course this exercise is similar skills, and a lot of the things that I say here about the benefits also apply to a mock trial program. Our sister school in Delaware has a mock trial program. But so this would be what happens in a courtroom. This spring I had jury duty. I missed 2 days of school, but it was a very edifying experience. I had never sat on a jury before, but I got to see how it was a case where the accused was assault within a prison, and so I got to see both sides make their case, the prosecution making their case that he was guilty and the defense making a case that he was not guilty. So it was fascinating to see how this translates into real life. You can also debate causal relationships, and this can also fall under proposition of fact. So in our league we debate it a few years ago resolved. Social media has enhanced human interaction more than it has degraded it. So obviously there's some value judgment there, and there can be debate about, well, how do you measure that? But is there a causal relationship between social media and human interaction? So what makes a good debate? What are we striving for when we do debate? There are several things. First, it's important to have a good resolution where both sides have a chance to make good arguments. It needs to be well balanced, where there's room for both sides to make good arguments. So within our group of schools, our league, our coaches, we discuss a resolution before announcing it to the students. We try to work through it and think about whether there's a possibility for good arguments on both sides. So as a teacher in a classroom, it's also something that you need to do. Is there a resolution where my students are going to feel like they got the short end of the stick and are at a disadvantage because they have to argue a particular side? So it should be one where there is enough out there that a good case can be made for either side. So, historical debates, or maybe like in a civics class, the Electoral College should be abolished. There's always arguments out there, and there's plenty of stuff that you can find for both sides of that. And then we talk about three burdens in debate, and this is the basis for which judges will make their decision, is the burden of proof, the burden of rebuttal, and the burden of communication. So the burden of proof, everybody must support their assertions, their arguments, with some sort of proof, which includes evidence and reasoning. The evidence includes the sort of the extrinsic things that you can get through research, through facts, through opinions from well-qualified sources with good credentials. It also includes the intrinsic proofs, the rhetorical proofs of ethos, logos, and pathos. Good debaters will draw on both to make their cases. There's the burden of rebuttal. The debaters must advance the debate by listening well and then responding to the arguments that the opponents actually make. They need to listen well, not to respond to the arguments that they wish their opponent had made, but they actually need to respond to what's actually been said and then deal with it. So then also the burden of communication. The debaters need to speak at a tone and rate which enables an audience to follow and to respond. So this includes being able to convey a clear outline to the listeners, because they don't have the script in front of them, so it needs to have previews, transitions, summaries, good signposting that helps the audience follow. And another benefit is that practice can also translate into better writing when it comes to writing, not just better speaking. So in order to have a good debate, each side must meet those three burdens. In tournaments, judges will base their decisions on that. And so in our class, we work through drills that I've listed at the end of the handout. And if I have time, I'll talk more about them. Now, how do you introduce debating as an activity in your classroom? There are several formats of debate that I recommend when you're starting out. At our school, we have 45-minute class periods, so that's a factor in choosing these shorter formats. One very popular format is the public forum debate. This is very accessible. It's designed to be judged by your average citizen. So oftentimes in tournaments, we have parents. That's really the main source of the judges that we get, is parents of debaters. We make sure they're not judging their own kid. We try to deconflict any conflict of interest. But this is team debate. It's designed for 2 versus 2. I've adapted it based on numbers of students that I've had, sometimes to be 3 and 3 on 3 or even 4 on 4. Each side gets, each student will then make a speech if you do a 4 on 4 format. But sometimes that can help if you have larger classes and want to get more through the activity. So it consists of 4-minute opening speeches for each side, pro and con, 3 minutes of crossfire where the first speakers take turns asking questions and answering them. Then each side has rebuttal speeches, which the second speaker does. And then those two speakers also engage in crossfire, questioning and answering each other. Then they have 2-minute summary speeches. They have another crossfire, and then 2-minute closing speeches. There's also the presidential debate, which is a one-on-one format. It's shorter than Lincoln-Douglas debate. So this is another one that's good for beginners. It's similar to public forum, except it's just one-on-one. There's a opening, a rebuttal, a crossfire, and there's moderator questions. This is the format used by the Ronald Reagan Great Communicator debate. And then there's the impromptu random theme debates, which we're going to do now. So is there anybody who would like to volunteer to be a debater today? Okay, good. So we have one, and then, bring up the glass jar too. Do we have a volunteer to be an opponent? Did I see any other? This is great.
Have courage.
Tim's trying to volunteer a lot of people in the room.
This is very good. Okay, so we're going to argue what classical education is more like. So that's why you put those terms in there. So you may be the first speaker and you can be the second speaker. So draw a topic. And so you're going to have classical education is like, so go ahead, what do you have?
It's like ice cream.
Okay. And then your topic is?
Like a bus ride.
Okay, so she will be arguing that classical education is like ice cream, and he will be arguing that classical Christian education. So that's what we're arguing in common. The common term is classical Christian education is like a bus ride. So I'm going to give them 5 minutes to prepare a 1-minute speech where they will try to argue why classical education is more like their term than the other person's term. Yes. And so they're going to have 1 minute to make their opening argument. Then they're going to have 1 minute to engage, asking each other questions. And then they'll each have a 30-second closing statement. So these go very quickly. My students really enjoy this activity, so hopefully you will too. Now, while they're preparing their arguments, I'll keep talking just to save a little bit of time. So I'll come over here, not to be right in their space. So I want to talk about what are the benefits of debate? So one benefit is that debate motivates students to conduct quality research. In a debate, students are assigned to make the best possible cases for or against a resolution, regardless of their own stance, whatever their stance was when they entered the topic. So the debater's guide sets out 7 criteria for good evidence, and I have students actually memorize this list as a way to check their own sources and to also have some questions to interrogate their opponent's sources. So the evidence must be recent, accurate, from a reliable source, readily available and verifiable, generally acceptable to the audience, free from obvious bias, and directly germane to the topic under discussion. But the neat thing about debate is that because of the competitive nature of debate, students challenge each other to find the best evidence possible. In a debate, students can expect to be cross-examined on their sources and on the credentials of those sources. Nobody wants to be accused of or found using so-called fake news. So if they're not prepared with good evidence, their opponent can seriously exploit that to their own advantage. And then another benefit of debate is that debate motivates students to understand different perspectives on an issue. Now, this is where some concerns might arise. Some might be concerned that debate encourages relativism by having to argue for a position that we don't agree with, or even one that violates scripture, which sometimes may happen. So in debate, are we merely creating sophists, like Socrates opposed, that they're just trying to make the weaker argument seem stronger and not really pursuing truth? But I've come to see that, and I've had my doubts about this too. And I've come to see that being able to fully and fairly articulate the best arguments on each side of an issue leads to greater clarity. It's so easy to dismiss an opposing view when we make a straw man out of it, when we distort what this view that we disagree with, when we distort what it is saying in order to make it more easy to shut down. When debaters are preparing to argue both sides of a debate, they're forced to find the strongest arguments to make the best possible case for each side. This can be challenging in a Christian school because we have certain non-negotiables about doctrine and about ethics. So this involves the idea that somebody is going to be the devil's advocate, so to speak. Now, I was really pleased to see Bruce Etter. And at the conference last year, the ACCS conference, he made a presentation where he introduced what he calls the Dostoevsky principle. And it's referring to a part of the novel, The Brothers Karamazov, where Dostoevsky, through the character of Ivan Karamazov, puts forth the strongest possible case for rejecting God. And it's a devastating case. It's one that actually within the novel, there is no rational rejoinder to. The answer in the novel is that the answer is a life, the life modeled by Father Zosima. But anyway, so the Dostoevsky principle, it's being able to fully do justice to a position even if we do not disagree with it, without distorting it. Now, others have pointed out that this is actually a way of loving our neighbor because we don't want to misrepresent them. We want to understand what their view is from the inside. And so debate can train students to have that, to have the full empathic understanding of where this opposing view is coming from. And they're giving voice to that within the debate. So I would like to pause there then and do this demonstration debate. So, are you both ready?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to actually give a microphone to and Rebecca as part of this, and then
Tony.
Yeah, Tony. And so you also have a microphone. So, and hopefully that one's working too. So I'm going to keep time. So I'll just be the moderator, and then each debater will make their 1 minute case, and then they'll have a 1 minute crossfire, and then they'll make a 30-second closing case.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is it appropriate to respond or speak against the other metaphor in our opening speech?
So yes.
If classical Jesus more like this or like that?
Because you just have one opening speech, yes, that would be fine.
And a question. So can I just kind of present why it's like my thing on the first and then come back with my rebuttal against Ephra here?
Yes, you can also do it that way. So again, this is more of a fun activity. So this isn't structured quite like a debate where we have both a constructive speech at the beginning and then a rebuttal speech. So kind of one speech has to do both.
This is great because I love ice cream. the answer I put in there was actually chocolate. So, but anyway, I think classical Christian education is very much like ice cream. Ice cream is so sweet, you know, it just tastes good. It just like feeds and satisfies your soul when you eat it. It's like, ah. And you know, when classical Christian education is done like that, it's just like, oh, that's just awesome. When you see those kids get it and grow and it, there's just nothing better, you know. So I kind of relate those things. And then the texture of ice cream. I mean, it's mostly creamy. And it just, you know, smooth. And I think when you deal in classical Christian education, you're dealing with truth. And it's going to work because it's true. But just like ice cream has a little chunk in there, I mean, you got to chew on it. You got to work through it. And that's kind of a struggle. You know, Christian education is not all totally smooth. But those struggles make it better in the end. And those chunks make the flavor good in the end. And those struggles bring out things in you and your kids that grow us all and refine us. I got a minute.
Classical education is very much like a bus ride. A bus is going somewhere, just like in classical education. We are on our way to heaven. The teacher is in a permeable space with the rest of the cabin. And just like in a classroom where the teacher has to have that sympathy and fellowship with the students, there's a freedom to classical education, much like in a bus. We don't wear seatbelts in a bus, nor are we strapped in our chairs in the classroom. There's a lot of windows in a bus because there's an openness to the outside world. We're interested in the world around us, but yet we're also separated, like in most vehicles, from the world around. I would also like to mention that classical education is in no way like ice cream. Ice cream is appealing to the lowest of our natures. It also cannot stand the heat of academic and classical rigor. By the way, Christian classical education is nourishing for life, meaning we should be able to feed on the things that we give our students forever. It won't work with ice cream.
Okay. And so now we'll have a minute where you can take turns asking questions, and we'll, you know, maybe we'll have Rebecca ask the first question, and then take turns from there.
Whew. That was good. You talked about freedom. Hmm. You know, is life about freedom? Freedom to do what?
Well, I think that there's a freedom within bounds, and I think that a school bus definitely provides that. That most school buses, you can't easily jump out of the window, although they are free to do that. But there's a freedom within boundaries that's appropriate to the school bus metaphor. Okay. Is classical education always sweet?
I think so. I think when you're doing what's right, even though it might be rough, it's still sweet. And you sleep well and have a good conscience. And that way, I think it's sweet.
Has that been true of all of your students?
We've only started this year. I can say
I
yes.
I rest my case. Who gets to go first? Okay.
I have to start again?
Yes. Just to sum up your arguments and why we should vote for you and not your opponent.
Well, you know, I think buses are like people. We always think about that career and that place where we're going. We got to get this, we got to get that, you know. And really, it's our soul that we should be concerned about and where it's going, not the end, but the journey. And I think ice cream is versatile. It's be found everywhere. Everyone loves it, rich, poor, and I think classical Christian education is the best thing that everybody needs, and it be taken to the ends of the world.
I agree completely with my competitor in that classical education is for everyone, but ice cream is not. I have a child who's lactose intolerant. And I just think you really have to go with school bus on this. School buses are for everybody.
All right, very good. I actually have a special gift for you. And aww, you might have this book, but
thank you.
If so, you can give it away to someone else because so that was actually that worked out better than I expected. Are you sure? Did either of you debate in school? Or well, that's really neat. So that kind of shows. I mean, the debate is like that, and it's also very attractive as a teacher. I could never do that sort of thing. I need to think well in advance. Thinking on my feet is very difficult. So that's why I had to write out my whole script for this thing. You know, it's the sort of and then so you see that and so that's just sort of a fun activity. Of course, that didn't require any research in a more structured debate class, or when you're doing a debate as an assignment in a regular class, of course you can assign them to write a full length case that will involve doing good research as well. So it's not just the stuff that we come up with off the top of our head. Although both of those were very edifying, and I'm sure that there's a lot of other really fascinating debates. Students like this activity too because they nominate terms to be used, and then they're always eager to see what somebody's going to do with a term that they have come up with. And so I have 10 minutes left, so I'm talking about the benefits of debate. And so we talked about this, what Bruce Hedder calls the Dostoevsky principle, learning to understand an opposing argument from the inside. And now another objection to this idea is that the focus in debate, especially in competitive debate, becomes more about winning than seeking the truth. And this was something that Isaac Watts addressed in his book on the improvement of the mind. So in a tournament, it's understood that whichever side a team is assigned to advocate, and that usually is determined maybe by a coin flip. You know, if you win the coin flip, you might get to choose the side. Or sometimes it's just assigned to you by a computer program schematic. And so it's understood that whatever you're advocating for does not necessarily represent what you really believe. And so judges are also instructed that you need to bracket out whatever your pre-existing views on the subject were and judge the round based only on what happens within the round, who meets those burdens of proof and rebuttal, who communicates their ideas clearly enough to you that you can follow what's going on. So over a tournament of several rounds, teams usually have to debate at least each side at least once, and the winning debaters are able to present their side convincingly. So it does seem like, okay, so is it just a game then about winning? Now, one thing I would challenge is that winning is not necessarily a bad motive. This does spur students to greater activity, to do better research, to make logical connections, to practice clarity in speaking. And so in my experience, I've seen students who are not normally excelling in the typical classes, they become galvanized through the challenge of competitive debate. And even when considered as games, it does have educational value. So that one History of Debate, Forensics in America by Michael D. Bartanen and Robert S. Littlefield, these authors observe that debates do have educational value. They have three S's: simulation, socialization, and social capital. So simulation, they say, by adopting rules and processes familiar to the courtroom and the legislative chamber, they take turns, they introduce and question the quality of the evidence, they do cross-examination. So participants practice in a relatively low-risk environment the techniques needed for future success, instinctively grasping the nuance of the actual context and situation where policy decisions or particular rulings might affect real life lives and livelihoods of individuals. So it's play now, it's a game now, but this is practice for real life engagement. And then also for socialization. This is a way for students to meet others with shared interest. So just as when we come together for the ACCS, we realize, oh, we're not alone in this endeavor. It's a great way to meet other people who are like-minded. And so it's also good to have students get together with students from other schools. That's why I'm so grateful to Rockbridge, to Summit, for participating with us in debate. And even when we participate in secular tournaments, the interactions can help. The kids who go to who are secular may not really understand, have not met a real Christian before, or who might have a character of a Christian, to see that these kids from the Christian school, you know, they're also real human beings. And so it can foster that sort of good social interaction. And then also debates create social capital. It broadens the students' knowledge about controversial social and political issues so that students become better citizens. And then another benefit is that debate gives us practice in speaking persuasively, concisely, and graciously. Now, it's well known that when students reach their middle school years, they enter what Dorothy Sayers and the Lost Tools of Learning calls the pert stage. So they become critical of everything. They love catching us in contradictions. So Sayers argued this is the ideal time to introduce dialectic into the curriculum. And in their book, Wisdom and Eloquence, Robert Littlejohn and Charles Evans also explain how this works out in the curriculum. So they argue that in addition to logic, or perhaps as part of the formal instruction in logic, students should be introduced to principles of debate. These skills will doubtless be honed in later years and will intermingle with the study of rhetoric. But their introduction to middle years students will fall into step with their cognitive and social development, their natural propensity to be argumentative. As students are learning to reason their way through issues and to construct their thoughts into formal syllogisms, affinity for and pleasure in argumentation develops naturally. Providing such students with rules for civil discourse, whether derived from forensic debate or Lincoln-Douglas style debate, or even from simple principles of courteous classroom discussion, can channel otherwise disruptive energies into valuable learning experiences. So that's from Wisdom and Eloquence. It challenges students to improve their rhetorical skills. Students may come prepared with an opening speech. That's as much as they know when they come prepared. They may be able to anticipate what their opponents might say, but oftentimes they need to listen so that they can then think and respond on their feet. And so our demonstrating debaters did a very good job of listening to each other and dealing with what each other said. I find that speakers become more dynamic in these situations when they're getting away from what they had prepared on paper. They become more animated and energetic when it gets into the later rounds of a debate. And as they practice speaking in these on-the-spot situations, they gain more confidence. Now, there's some concerns related to this, too. Does it really encourage good speaking? If you go to many contemporary high school debate tournaments, you might see that there's a culture of the idea becomes, well, how fast can you speak so that you can just get all of your evidence into the allotted time? They call this spreading. So it's like speed reading. And they're just trying to say it as fast, sort of like when somebody speaks fast at the end of one of those commercials telling you about the side effects of the drugs and how they'll do all these. So it's very fast speaking. And so oftentimes in a debate tournament, you might see students who are just speaking as fast as they can. Or oftentimes in some formats using a lot of debate jargon, terms that are specialized to a particular format of debate that the average person cannot follow. So that is a problem, and people have noticed that, you know, the poor rhetoric, because that's not good communication, that fast speaking, jargon laden language that doesn't really communicate. You know, we're talking about ethos, pathos, logos. Now, your best bet then is to find other schools, other classical Christian schools, other like-minded schools or independent leagues that value eloquent and persuasive speech. So that was one of the reasons for the founding of the Mid-Atlantic Christian Debate League, as explained by Bradley Finkbeiner of Rockbridge Academy. He had tried to go to these secular tournaments and found they were just speaking so fast. We don't want our students to speak like that. So they founded this league. So we use the public forum format. It's very accessible and designed to be judged by non-experts. So jargon and speed talking is discouraged. There's two events that I recommend that are, you know, outside of, you know, these are tournaments that anyone can enter. The big questions debate. So in their judge training, they explicitly tell you we don't want to use jargon. These are debates that are focused on the intersection of science, philosophy, and religion. Students can debate as individuals or in teams of two. It's similar to a public forum debate format. And in their judge training, they explicitly say, we don't want spreading. We don't want that speed rapid talking and jargon because it should communicate to regular people as judges. And then another one's this Ronald Reagan Great Communicator debate. They have several regionals that take place each year, and then they culminate in a national tournament in California. So I'm proud to say we have a student from Tall Oaks who won the Mid-Atlantic Regional this year and is going out to California next month. And so they also, in their judge training, they show videos of Ronald Reagan speaking, and they say, this he was the great communicator. He told stories. He moved people with his language. He connected with people. And so this series of debates is modeled after that. There's homeschool associations, like the National Christian Forensics and Communication Association. So I can't speak firsthand of their rhetorical culture of that organization, but they offer policy debate and Lincoln Douglas value debate. Now there's a lot more that I could talk about. So if you have any questions, I have a list of possible assignments there. I have documents that if you're interested in what they are, I can send you one or all of those. I can send you the course description of what we do in our argumentation and debate course that includes some of the books that we read. I can send you a bibliography of works that I use to prepare for this talk. So thank you all for your attention. Thank you all. Thank you especially to our two demonstrating debaters. And I really enjoyed sharing this all with you. So enjoy the rest of the conference.